make sure it's done right.
Senate Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy will come to order, please. We're going to open. Welcome, by the way, on a Monday morning. Some of you have traveled a long way to get here. We really appreciate it. We do have public hearings and work sessions posted in case we want to go to a work session, but if there are amendments and various concerns of bills, we will probably not move them immediately. We do have to have both a fiscal impact and a revenue impact before the bill leaves the committee. So those are new rules that we will have to work on before we actually move the bill. So with that, I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 12. Phil Donovan, would you come up, please? Yes, Jennifer will give a recap of the bill, please.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 12 provides tax credits for principal and interest payments on qualifying student loans made by health care practitioners serving medically underserved areas.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians and appreciate your allowing us to testify first. Dr. Nedro is from Ashland and has some time constraints. First off, I just want to share with the committee that nearly 700 naturopathic physicians practice in the state of Oregon, approximately 100 of which are in rural communities, and another 50 that we know are working with underserved populations. The kind of legislation that you're considering with Senate Bill 12 does a great thing in creating incentives for healthcare professionals to work in rural Oregon. However, as the legislation is currently drafted, it excludes important healthcare professionals like naturopathic physicians and physical therapists. We've had a Dash 1 amendment drafted up for your consideration that would include both naturopathic physicians and physical therapists to be included in this incentive program. As it relates to naturopathic physicians, they work as primary care physicians and can help bridge the gap between healthcare need and healthcare services. Two of them are here with me today to describe the work that they're doing both in rural Oregon and with underserved populations. And if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Dr. Bonnie Nedro.
Hello.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for your time. I think probably you'd be most interested in hearing about what my practice is like and what sort of communities I serve. I'm focusing on pediatrics and got my training in Seattle and had my practice there for several years and then moved down to Ashland to move to a smaller community for my family. About 25 to 30% of my practice is pediatric clients. Until June of this year, I was on Oregon Health Plan and was able to serve this community. Well, you may think, well, Ashland's got some money. This is the community who doesn't have money in Ashland, and they're really, really struggling. In June, they dropped us from their plans. So what I do now for that community is I give them a substantial cash discount. And we're also, I have another naturopath down there with me. We're starting to offer group well-child visits. So we'll do some educational pieces, which is our strength as naturopathic physicians. A lot of these parents also don't want to go to other doctors because they don't get their questions answered because there's not enough time, especially when you're talking about these communities that doctors don't get well paid for Oregon Health Plan. So the visits tend to be short. They don't get the education. This is what the parents need. How do I keep my kids healthy so that we don't end up having problems down the road? So we do some group sessions to help meet those needs. Another community that I serve are geriatric populations, about 20% of my practice. And, of course, most of those folks are on Medicare. However, they're having lots of side effects from their meds or they're trying to get off of some medications because they don't feel great. And, of course, it's an out-of-pocket. And these are people with fixed income. So they're coming to my door saying, please help me with these concerns that I have. About half of my population is uninsured. So they're paying cash for whatever services they can get, and they're looking for something that's going to help support their lifestyle so that they can't afford surgeries, they can't afford prescription meds. So they're looking for preventative, truly preventative health care. I've just joined a team of practitioners, chiropractors, counselors, nutritionists, and we're working on community health care plans, classes where people come in. And, you know, we all know we should exercise. We all know we should eat well, but it doesn't. You need support to do that. So we do ongoing classes with these folks to really try and get the health care costs down, because that's what's getting all of us. And they're coming in droves to our classes to say, how can we do this?
And Mr. Chair, also with us today is Dr. Mike Owens, who's a recent graduate of the National College of Natural Medicine in Portland, who's working with migrant workers and others, and I'll let you share. Okay.
Mr. Chair and Committee, thanks for having us here. So thank you for your time. So my name is Dr. Michael Owen, and I graduated from NCNM. And I'm here because I'm interested in having more incentive for naturopathic physicians. As naturopathic physicians, I don't know how much you know about them, but we're trained as primary care physicians. All of our clinical training is in outpatient community clinics. So our rotations are usually just spent in outpatient and inside the community. NCNM, the National College of Natural Medicine, is part of the Coalition for Community Clinics. So we see a lot of the populations that are uninsured or underinsured, and also do a lot of outreach for homeless youth and things like that. So after that type of training, of course, we all want to go out and get jobs in communities because that's what we've been trained in. Unfortunately, a lot of physicians don't feel that they can afford to live in those communities and make it financially. For me, I work in North Portland, Woodburn, and in Grants Pass, which seems like a long stretch, but, you know, family in Grants Pass, and I grew up there, and I really like the community. Fortunately, I have to keep a job here in Portland in order to kind of make ends meet. I do outreach in Portland, so it is. I work in a walk-in clinic, so I see a lot of acute cases for people without insurance or traveling on the road that just can't afford to go to either walk-in clinics or make it to the ER. So I feel that naturopaths are designed for being family doctors and working in communities, and I think there'd be a lot more heading out into those communities if there were incentives for help in as far as finances go.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Thank you. Questions, comments? Underserved area, how do we define that?
Mr. Chair, the legislation isn't precise in that definition, but when we refer to underserved populations, we're typically talking about people like migrant workers. Mm-hmm. There's a clinic here in Salem that we're doing a lot of work with, also working with homeless youth, gay youth, with the Outside In Clinic in Portland. Those are examples when we're referring to an underserved population. The legislation, I think, is more intended towards rural parts of the state, and hence why we brought in a couple of physicians that are practicing in rural communities.
Tell me about your underserved rural area.
One of the things that I find interesting is that I've got people coming from over an hour away. Williams is another community about 45 minutes from Ashland, and they come in droves from there. They drive in to see me. I wish there was someone there in Williams because they don't get the care that they need. In Ashland itself, you'd say, well, shoot, you should have a lot of physicians there. We just lost one of our pediatricians, an MD who was, you know, lured to a better job in Corvallis. So people are on wait lists to try to get into the pediatric care. And, you know, you think, well, that shouldn't be a problem, but it is a problem for these folks. Trying to get into any sort of urgent care, I get a lot of phone calls. I need to get in and see. Well, they're not connected with any physicians. They're uninsured. They don't have a way in, and they're afraid to go to the emergency room. So I get these phone calls on, you know, Saturday evening and helping people figure out, well, how do I maneuver in this healthcare system? Where do I go? I have this thing happening. I don't know who to turn to. I don't know who to talk to. And so it feels very unserved to me when I hear from my community.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And thank you for driving all the way from Ashland.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Robert Delf. Yes. Okay, Medical Society. Portland. And did you drive 100 miles?
Round trip, sir.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
Good. Welcome. Would you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, good morning. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, I am Robert Delf, Executive Director of the Medical Society of Metropolitan Portland. Our organization is dedicated to, quote, physicians creating the best environment in which to care for patients, quote. We believe the passage of Senate Bill 12 will help create a better environment in which to care for patients. A robust health workforce is critical to assuring access to medical care. And Senate Bill 12 provides a feasible vehicle to increase access to those who reside in medically underserved areas. Our medical society, located a short distance from the OHSU School of Medicine, has nearly 1,500 members, 312 of whom are medical students. Our governing body consists of physicians, a resident physician, a public member, and a medical student. We are well aware of the financial challenges faced by medical students, many of whom incur tens of thousands of dollars in debt prior to graduation. We have listened to students who have as much as a $250,000 debt obligation upon graduation. Although this does not diminish the desire to care for others, the students must consider their debt load when reflecting on a medical specialty and practice environment. The magnitude of debt may influence the choice of specialty and may pressure students away from primary care specialties and underserved areas. Senate Bill 12 provides a credit against the taxes that are otherwise due for principal and interest payments on qualifying loans. The passage of Senate Bill 12 will materially assist and enable medical students to expand their choices regarding how to serve the community. The second component of the bill requires the provider taxpayer to serve in a medically underserved area and devote to qualifying service more than 60% of the provider's working hours during the tax year. We recommend that the committee consider an expanded definition of medically underserved areas to include the urban and metropolitan areas within Oregon. For example, according to a 2007 report published by the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation, the metropolitan Portland Tri-County region has a population of about 1.5 million people. Of those, 251,000 are uninsured and have no predictable or sustainable access to medical care. That represents 16% of the population and clearly suggests an underserved area. There are local initiatives that are responding to this challenge. For example, Project Access of Northwest Oregon and Washington, which we call Project Access Now, of which our medical society is a founding member, is a regional organization that facilitates collaboration for local project access programs in the metropolitan Portland area. Project Access Now coordinates a volunteer network of physicians in the greater Portland metropolitan area, and we have about 1,700 participating physicians who volunteer their time, talent, and professional expertise on a pro bono basis. The project also includes the participation of hospitals, a pharmacy program, and more. It is not an insurance plan and does not guarantee any specific care, but Project Access is committed to helping people connect to the care that they need. I'm noting this to emphasize the fact that there are underserved areas other than in rural Oregon. Okay. Senate Bill 12 would help communities make the very best use of available new and available in new resources, while we, as a community, a state, and a nation, develop a broader health care solution. Lack of access to medical care is not just a rural or non-urban concern, but affects the lives of all who are low income and uninsured and need a better pathway to care. We support Senate Bill 12. It will facilitate the expansion of choices available to medical student professionals and serve our communities by providing a powerful incentive for physicians and other healthcare professionals to remain in and serve Oregonians. I would now like to offer a brief statement from our Medical Society's president. He is not here, able to be here today, caring for patients as we speak. Dear committee members, my name is Dr. John Evans, and again, I'm reading his statement. Mm-hmm. I am president of the Medical Society of Metropolitan Portland. In my role on our board, I have had the opportunity to interact with many medical students and residents, and we have their representation on our board and within the other societies and healthcare projects that we cooperate with. There is an overriding theme in our contact with these young physicians. This is the overwhelming concern about the huge debt loads that they are taking on as they start their careers and their families. These are motivated, idealistic, young people, many of whom want to provide primary care but are increasingly sensing they will never be out of debt if they do so. Our medical student board representative recently told us that the first year tuition has risen to $47,000 for the coming year in medical school. Having an award or plum to reward caregivers to work in medically underserved areas is a useful motivator in the complex series of decisions they make for their career's direction. This is not only dictating location, but also area of practice. It is critical that we nurture these fires of desire to work in primary care and underserved areas. As our society has been a leader in helping provide care for patients without the resources to pay, by our early support in encouraging staffing for project access, we are very concerned with this important and helpful bill, SB 12, is dedicated only to rural areas. It is very clear that there are medical underserved areas within the Portland area. I myself served in the public health service for 3 years, paying back my obligation. The medically underserved area was in the Multnomah County Detention Center, and I worked the night clinic in Albina. These were satisfying and rewarding years. We at the Medical Society of Metropolitan Portland vigorously endorse SB 12 and encourage its passage. We also strongly encourage the scope to include areas that are not only rural, but meet the definition of medical underserved that we see in areas of the Portland metropolitan area. Thank you all for the opportunity for input into this important bill to increase the availability of medical care in the state of Oregon. Respectfully, John Evans, MD.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're getting into definitions here, and that's where it gets complicated. Just look historically at our ability to define rural for some of our tax credits. And I guess, Mr. Chair, my concern is, clearly the bill doesn't exclude Portland because it says underserved areas.
Yes.
My question is, how do we get a definition that doesn't create a bureaucratic nightmare? And I'm not asking you for the answer, but because it's been given to Office of Rural Health to come up with definition, I think that's going to be Ms. Chair, that's something I think I'd like to get a better sense of. I totally support this bill, but there are some unknowns still working here that I think we need to kind of get a sense of scope and impact before we move too far forward on it.
Okay. Senator Verger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your testimony, and much of what you said I agree with for Metropolitan Portland and the rest of Oregon,
mm-hmm.
and that is that we just need to address the healthcare system.
Yes.
But affordability and accessibility for Oregonians I do not see as the purpose of Senate Bill 12. My reading of it is to encourage physicians, young people coming out of medical school, to settle in a rural area such as Reedsport, who has one doctor.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not about the accessibility or affordability of those who live in Reedsport as much as it is to have a doctor there who can at least have someone on call at the hospital. The metropolitan areas have a different kind of problem, and that is with the people that are being served, not so much the number of physicians that are located. So I see just a difference in where we're, and I feel free to have you comment on that.
Well, the only comment I could probably offer is that we, as a community, should focus on the people rather than necessarily where they live exclusively, because 250,000 people in the greater Portland area
mm-hmm.
have difficulty accessing medical care, and it's not sustainable, it's not predictable, and we need to serve all people who need medical care.
Yes, I totally agree with that, and also I agree very much with some of the testimony that you heard prior to yours about preventive care, rather than just focusing on treating people when they're ill, is in helping people stay well, and I'm thrilled that we're going in that direction, but I see the rural areas where there's just no accessibility at all to a physician, and having to travel for many people is out of the question.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay.
But Scott's not here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No, Scott is not here.
No, he just sent a letter.
Okay. Well, we need some answers from him.
Yeah, okay. I agree.
Chairman, I have a question.
Yeah.
The revenue or fiscal impact to the bills will come at what point?
We're going to ask for them.
I think if we're going to consider an amendment, we need to get the revenue impact on that amendment as well as the bill itself. And that would be my...
It changes the discussion.
Yeah, it does.
It certainly does.
Yeah.
Chair and Senator Berger, the revenue and fiscal offices are really busy folks. I don't think they necessarily tend to get excited about a bill till they know we're serious about it, and we will communicate that at this point. So,
okay. Ingrid Deckard? Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Inga Deckert with Tonkin Torp, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. The OPTA is comprised of more than 1,000 physical therapists, physical therapy assistants, and physical therapy students in Oregon. Currently, there is a shortage of physical therapists in Oregon and nationally, which is probably no surprise for any of you to hear. This shortage is projected to get worse as the baby boomers age. And in addition to the aging baby boomers, there are two other populations that are requiring an increase in physical therapy services. It is putting even more pressure on the existing physical therapists offering services out there. And those are the increasing population of the folks with chronic disease, such as diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease. And in addition, the number of returning injured soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan who are coming home and requiring rehabilitative services that are provided by physical therapists. And we do know that the shortage is particularly acute in rural areas, as just mentioned earlier in general from Senator Berger, from healthcare providers in her area. And there was a study that was conducted by the Shepps Center for Health Services Research on behalf of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, which illustrates, I mean, these are national numbers, but I think they're also reflective of what's happening here in Oregon. And their study showed that for residents in counties that were designated health provider shortage areas, there's approximately 1.2 physical therapists for every 10,000 residents, and in all other counties outside of those shortage counties, there are 4 physical therapists for every 10,000 residents. And as I say, I think even though those are national numbers, that's probably fairly close to what's happening here in Oregon as well. Oregon has one school that offers a doctor in physical therapy degree, and that's Pacific University. And I have here with me a Pacific University PT student. He's in his third year. His name is Josh Zavertnik, and he'd like to talk to you for a few minutes about the length of education that's required to obtain a degree in physical therapy and some of the costs associated with that, and then going out and practicing once you have the degree, and what may be some opportunities or barriers out there.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for having me here. I am a third-year physical therapy student, as Inga indicated, and in order to even be in the Doctorate of Physical Therapy program, I've had to complete a four-year undergraduate degree at an accredited educational facility, college. Anyways, the what you can do through that is that you need to have had some type of four-year degree, and it can be in any field. It doesn't necessarily have to be medically based, but there are certain requirements that you need to have fulfilled in order to be there. So for some people, just a four-year degree was not enough, and having to go back and get some more sciences and things like that in order to even be accepted into the program. So you have your four-year degree, and then now you're into your doctorate of physical therapy, and you have to have, that is a three-year program at Pacific University. And currently right now, just tuition alone is just under $25,000. And as you look to have cost of living, books and food and things of that nature, they tell you to expect upwards to about $40,000 a year for 3 years. And so we have that burden to take on. And the unfortunate aspect of physical therapy as it is right now is that we have this debt load that we will sustain in our 3 years, but we don't have the earning potential that would be reserved for different medical professions, so that when we come out, that $120,000 or $120,000 plus is a little bit more significant for us, because we don't have the ability to have a higher wage, at least right off out of school. But we do have potential to earn more, but as it is right now, that debt to income ratio is just fairly significant for us.
Would it be cheaper to go to a rural area and get a tax credit, or go to a metro area where you could find a better paying job, is the question. That's one of the questions.
Well, part of the problem with some of the looking into a metropolitan area to work is that there is a fairly saturated market, at least within Portland. Mm-hmm. So the competition, a lot of people, obviously, as they come out of school, can look to an area that maybe they would want to live in. And I think for some of us coming out of school, a metropolitan area is a little bit more appealing than maybe a rural area. And because of that, the competition for jobs is a little bit more fierce, and they don't need to pay the clinics or the hospitals don't need to pay you a tremendous amount of money to keep you in that area, because there's reasons why you would stay there. Whereas stepping into a rural area, some people might find that a little bit more appealing based upon looking at cost of living, quality of life, and then at the same time knowing that there was some sort of tax credit or some way for them to help unload some of the debt that they have received. That would be appealing, definitely. And just in conversation with amongst some of my classmates, I know that they've discussed this, and this is something that we've talked about.
Yeah, and it says underserved as well, and that's part of the ambiguity of mm-hmm. this bill is we don't know for sure what, you know, there's a case to be made, as the last speaker said, that, you know, an underserved area in the metro should qualify. We haven't considered that. This is basically under the auspices of the Rural Health Department, so we're thinking rural, but even then we don't know for absolutely certain. Grants Pass has for the purposes of assistance with malpractice, Grants Pass was eliminated. No, or did they put them back in?
We carved them back in. So.
Carved them back in. Okay. Ashland was left in. Ashland is not left in. Well, for
no, Ashland we carved out.
Oh, but we left, but we did leave the doctors, we did leave a number of doctors.
Ashland, the OBs are still in.
They're OBs.
Everybody else is out.
Okay. That was a condition of moving the bill out of the committee, is that they left the doctors in Ashland in that bill. Okay, so that's one of the ambiguities that we hope to get straight. In fact, the director of the Rural Health at OHSU call that to our attention, is that the definition of rural and underserved needs to be better understandable. So, Inga.
Oh, and I was just going to add, if I could, Mr. Chair, to the point of you know, the sort of urban underserved areas versus rural underserved areas. When I was speaking with some physical therapists in preparing for this testimony this morning, I spoke with a woman who is the rehabilitation director at Providence, and they have offices, you know, located throughout the state. And she said that in Silverton, Newburgh, and Seaside, they have had some positions for physical therapists open for as long as 2 years, unable to attract a physical therapist to those areas. And so that's just kind of another, it's anecdotal, but, you know, an example of what is happening on the ground here in Oregon as far as, for, you know, whether it be financial or other reasons, having difficulty attracting physical therapists to the area to serve the citizens there.
Thank you. That demographic would be good to know. In fact, I may ask the Office of Rural Health if they have some information about where the needs are in the different areas that are being that take advantage of this program. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Joe Egris, I don't know if I got that right, but we'll see how close I came. Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute. Joe.
Welcome. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Joe Isgrig, the Executive Director of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute. Thank you for this opportunity to be here today. We had the privilege and honor of being able to do some of the background work working with the Senate Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform to provide some information into the development of this particular bill. Many of the discussions that you've heard already with the Health Fund Board and in other arenas, you already know of the workforce shortage. And you know of the difficulty of recruiting primary care practitioners out into our rural areas. There are two ways that Oregon, several ways that Oregon works to help distribute practitioners out into the rural areas and underserved areas. One is the student loan repayment program, and that's been particularly effective. It's said to be particularly effective, and communities particularly appreciate that one to help recruit particularly primary care practitioners out into their communities. The second is the rural practitioner tax credit.
Yes, Senator Moniz Anderson, sorry
Thank
about
you.
That.
Regarding the student loan repayment, how much of the loan is paid?
It's paid back within a particular time period, so 3 to 5. So it may not cover the total amount of the loans.
But it could?
Depending on the practitioner.
Could you cite an example of one that would be paid off if they spent, 3 years or 2 years?
Well, just as an example, let's say a nurse practitioner who has had a work experience, then went work experience, paid off early loans, if he or she used any of those, went back to school to get a nurse practitioner degree for a couple of years. It's a shorter period of time, in addition to perhaps paying out of their own savings. They didn't take on a larger debt loan, so that amount might be a little bit smaller, paid off within a particular period of time. For a individual who goes straight out of high school into nursing school and on into a nurse practitioner program, particularly now as they're becoming doctorate programs, that's going to be a higher debt loan, and that payment may not cover the amount of time it takes to pay off that loan.
Follow up?
Yes.
I was just wanting to know the exact amount. Is it a capped amount for each person over a period of time, or is it a formula?
I believe that...
And if you don't have the answer, that's fine, but I certainly would like to
have that answer. Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz Anderson, loan repayments are not to exceed $25,000 for the year for each year of education and not to extend by either 3 or 5 years depending on the profession.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Interestingly, the same categories under the tax credit are under the student loan. That would be the physicians, physician assistants, dentists, pharmacists, and nurse practitioners qualify for the student loans. and these are the same individuals who are currently under the tax credit. So that's a good question to make us aware. Okay.
Just in follow-up, as you already know, there are those. This is particularly a nice tool to add to the tool chest, and that's a nice analogy. Just one more way in which communities can help recruit the needed practitioners into care for their citizens. For primary care practitioners in particular, and those who are the first access point into the healthcare system, those who might graduate with similar debt loads in the primary care specialties yet have different salaries than their counterparts or their colleagues who choose different medical specialties or health specialties would find that this would help be able to offset some of the financial burden that's caused by their loans. Again, by way of some background information, on the tax side of this, on the revenue side of this, the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute is currently working to conduct a study of the economic impact of primary care physicians in rural communities, much like has been conducted in other areas of the U.S. In Mississippi, a study found that one new rural practitioner contributes anywhere from $120,000 to $2 million to the makes economic contributions equal to $120,000 to $2 million, and perhaps even as small as creating 7 new jobs for that particular community. So on the tax side or the revenue side of this, there is a, certainly a contribution that bringing practitioners into communities can make to that as well.
The category of physician as a primary care doctor is obvious. What about physician assistant and nurse practitioner who operate semi-independently as primary care?
In terms of their economic contributions?
I want you to tell me if a nurse practitioner and a physician assistant who operate in a community primarily as the only quote-unquote primary care are truly primary. Do they qualify as primary care? Because they operate technically under the direction of a physician.
I think many of those in those occupations are identified in primary care roles. So, depending on the work that they're doing.
Okay, because yes. There is definitely a shortage of MDs in medical school who want to become primary care physicians. So we rely more and more on nurse practitioners and physician assistants. How independent are they of the supervising physician?
You know, I wish I had one of my physicians here to be able to answer that question for you in terms of the regulatory structure on that. Many of the communities in which there are only physicians assistants operating, I know, are particularly important to those communities
yeah.
providing the primary care. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's a lot of connection with the Office of Rural Health, as you had identified earlier in OHSU, in providing the backup and some of the expertise that's needed to help those practitioners.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions? Go ahead.
So just in wrap-up, we know that there are some administrative logistical issues with this bill and some clarification of the definitions that are needed. In addition, you might want to consider an evaluation piece after 4 years to see if this is going to be an effective policy. Certainly, the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute is willing to support the committee's work on being able to address those issues.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Morris Anderson.
So with this bill, a person would still qualify for the $5,000 tax credit that we already have in law, plus then $12,000 against their loan with this bill. Is that correct?
The way that this is currently proposed and the way the rural health practitioner tax credit is structured, yes, it is possible that they could be eligible for both.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
you. Art Towers, would you come up, please?
Good Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And our union is neutral on this legislation, but I did want to come visit with you because we do have some anxiety about the issue of tax credits in general. This effort, the idea behind this bill, behind Senate Bill 12, is really worthy, and improving rural health care is an important deal. We have a lot of rural members, and this is really on the right track, I think, in a lot of regards. But in this tough budget situation we find ourselves in, we worry about every dollar going out the door because we don't have the funds necessary to draw down all the federal dollars that we need to help balance the budget. And this is particularly a big issue in rural health care, where Medicaid matching funds from the federal government bring in $1.66 for every dollar that the state expends. And so since in the governor's recommended budget, there's a shortfall of general fund that would entail a loss of over $700 million in federal funds, we're worried about expenditures on projects that don't bring down the federal match. As this impacts rural health care, one of the big programs that receives that federal match is long-term care. And the members of this committee over the years have really done a great job and really demonstrated a commitment to long-term care for elderly and disabled Oregonians. And whether it's adult foster care or home care, nursing homes, assisted living, y'all have done just a tremendous job on that issue. And in many rural counties, we have a disproportionate share of long-term care recipients. In fact, in four counties, Coos, Josephine, Wheeler, and Wasco, more than 5% of the county workforce is engaged in the long-term care industry. And so, again, Senate Bill 12, the idea behind it is strong. It's very much a worthy effort, but just heads up that for every dollar we spend in terms of tax credits is $1.66 in federal funds that we don't get. So I just wanted to register that because the issue of tax credits will be a big one all session long. So thank you.
Thank you. Are you aware of the total amount of tax expenditures that the state of Oregon pays out each year?
Chair Morissette, I don't have that figure at my fingertips, and recognize that this isn't, we aren't talking here about a gigantic expenditure by any stretch of the imagination. This is probably a relatively small one compared to many of the others. And so I recognize that and appreciate it, but did just want to register that concern.
Are you aware of how many small tax expenditures go out the door each year? Kind of a 2-to-1 ratio with the general fund.
That's right.
Questions? Comments? Okay. Thank you, Arthur.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Steiner, would you come? Yes. You're back there shaking your head, so you're going to keep us honest, right?
I wouldn't say that, Mr. Chair. I would just say that I'm delighted to have the opportunity to come testify to you and the members of this committee. My name is Elizabeth Steiner. I'm a family physician from Portland, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, which represents over 1,000 practicing physicians across Oregon. Thank you for offering me the opportunity to come testify in support of Senate Bill 12. As it happens, I did take time off from my practice today to come testify because we believe that this bill is so important. Senate Bill 12, as you know, will offer these tax credits to healthcare practitioners who practice in medically underserved areas and who have qualifying loans. We support this bill because we believe it will enhance access to high-quality primary care healthcare services for Oregonians. Many family physicians desire to practice in medically underserved areas because they are motivated to enhance the health of our most needy patients. However, they do face significant barriers to practicing in these areas. As you've already heard, many physicians graduate medical school with, on average, $200,000 in debt.
While no family physician expects to earn an enormous salary, reimbursement in medically underserved areas is often so low that those with significant debt cannot afford to repay their loans in a timely fashion. Implementing Senate Bill 12 will offer physicians increased freedom to follow their preferred path of practicing in these underserved areas. Extensive evidence, both in the United States and around the world, has shown that populations who have good access to primary care health care services have improved health, lower levels of chronic disease, longer life expectancies, and lower health care costs overall. In fact, it is estimated that one Oregonian dies every day because of lack of access to basic health care services. In a time when so many Oregonians lack access to these critically important services, in part because it is so hard for family physicians to manage their debt burden while working in underserved areas, passage of Senate Bill 12 will enhance access for Oregonians across the state. As you mentioned, Scott Ekblad, director of the Office of Rural Health, has offered some a variety of suggestions to enhance this bill, including some definitions of underserved areas, and we support these definitions as well. With reference to the question that Senator Montes Anderson asked the previous witness, the possibility would exist that practitioners could be eligible both for the rural tax credit and this one, but not necessarily both. Some rural areas do not qualify as medically underserved areas, so it would really work to enhance the possibility of locating physicians in true medically underserved areas by offering this additional incentive. We do appreciate the testimony and the concern of the previous witness with regard to budget neutrality and decreasing tax revenue. However, we'd also like to point out that physicians are known to have a very high economic multiplier in communities, including employing on average 3 to 4 people per physician in better than family wage jobs, which certainly contribute to tax revenues for the state, which I would believe would more than offset any losses incurred by this bill. The Oregon Academy of Family Physicians is committed to working with the state legislature to ensure that every Oregonian has access to basic health care services. Accomplishing this goal will have a salutary effect on our economy, our ability to educate our children, and our productivity. And Senate Bill 12 is one piece of the puzzle that will move us toward this goal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
We've heard the people who've signed up to testify. Anyone else wishing to testify? Okay. For the record, Jim Welch of the Oregon State Grange has a letter in support of Senate Bill 12. Scott Ekblad, Office of Rural Health, has a letter. Okay. Jim Welch is from the Cattlemen's Association.
He submitted two letters, on behalf of Oregon Cattlemen and one on behalf of Oregon State Grange.
So, Jim Welch submitted two letters, one on behalf of the Oregon Cattlemen and one on behalf of the Oregon Grange. Okay, Scott Ekblad submitted a letter that wants to talk about the definition of the need underserved area, which came up a couple times in testimony, and I think that's important to do. As Senator Cruz mentioned earlier, we've been dealing with the definition of rural Oregon. I don't know if we want to get into that for this purpose. I think underserved.
Mr. Chair, that's one of the things Scott mentions in his letter is that this program shouldn't be seen as a replacement for the existing rural health services program. So we should make sure that continues intact. And this is a different critter than that one is, and so the definitions in this program don't necessarily need to be mixed with that. When I'm looking at all of the angst we went through creating definitions last time for that program, I think hopefully they can stay intact and that program can continue, but having slightly different definitions here may be appropriate, and it would be very helpful to get from Scott at least a ballpark of what he's working on,
yes,
as how he would define this specific universe. So,
okay, thank you very much. Yes, Senator.
I think there's a broader question that that has some fallout impact on bills like Senate Bill 12, and that is that the way that we're structured in this country to educate people for health practitioners, doctors, physical therapists, naturopaths, it's very expensive. And so what we can do to help those who really just want to serve, whether it's metropolitan or rural, we need to think in terms of that. Otherwise, it's only going to be the people who can afford, mm-hmm, to go to those schools. So you would have people not necessarily qualified, but just based on buying the medical degree. And I don't think that's really what we want. Countries outside of the United States do some interesting things with that, and it's based on testing of your ability to serve. In other words, your intelligence, your emotional stability, and all of those things. And if you qualify, you actually get to go to school free. So when you go to a doctor, you know you're getting the smartest and not necessarily one at the bottom of the class, but simply came from a rich family. So I think that there's a whole thought process here of trying to help people that really want to go into the health profession, because honestly, it's a labor of love for many people. So
I agree. There's a particular need for primary care physicians, and there's a noticeable decline, significant decline, in medical school for people who want to become primary care. Specialties are more profitable.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question in regard to Senate Bill 12. Is this credit a refundable credit, or is this up to the... Meaning, if you have zero tax, are you going to get the $12,000, or do you have to have $12,000 of tax in order to reap the benefits of the full $12,000?
I think you have to have the tax to be able to get the credit in this particular program.
So that may be an obstacle for some reaping some of this benefit to begin with,
mm-hmm,
having that $12,000 tax.
Well, assuming that they're going to practice, once they start practicing, their income will obviously cover the amount of the tax, I think. And then the student loan part of it, the same people who are currently eligible for the tax credit are currently eligible for the student loan, but you can't have both.
Mm-hmm.
So the student loan might help them get through school, and then if they... that student loan has been forgiven at some point, they may at some point in the future apply for the tax credit.
Well, I guess I'm perplexed in that I'm a CPA and I do taxes, and in order to get a $12,000 credit, you would have to have taxable income after all deductions of about $115,000 or so. So that's pretty high income, particularly if you're a self-employed person who's just starting out their practice and maybe recognizing losses. So, but obviously that would have a major fiscal impact also, depending on whether this is a refundable credit or not. So...
Do we go ahead?
I'm not sure. It's one of the dangers you have when you have a CPA on your
team. Sorry.
But I think that's a valid question that needs to be answered.
Yeah. Yes, and I think that's a very good question, because if you practice in rural Oregon and have less than the standard income to qualify for a tax credit, does that mean that you're not qualified? Boy, you better... we'll write you. Would you make a note of that, please, so we can check that? No, seriously, I think that's an excellent question.
Very good question.
Well, to follow up, because my concern is if I'd also like to have a conversation on whether this is rural, but let's assume you're working in Brothers, Oregon, and, you know, this was an incentive to move there. You're not going to have $115,000 of taxable income, so
mm-hmm.
I guess it's almost moot, and nobody's going to take advantage of this or be able to take advantage of it. So,
well, I think that is a great insight into what may be lacking from? I don't know. That's an excellent question, and we'll find out.
Do I get points
you
for
get
that?
Points. Yeah, yeah. Would you make note of that, Senator Telfer?
Two and a half points.
Okay. 2.5 points. Who is a brand new senator?
Immediately gets points. Yes.
Senator Montezemolo.
And that's why we truly need to make sure that the loan repayment programs are doing what they're supposed mm-hmm. to do, because mm-hmm. that is, I think, very beneficial. I've known personally nurse practitioners who have wanted to live in the metro area but truly could not afford to, so took their 3-year stint and actually went to Idaho and did the three-year stint there and actually spent 4 years there and then came back.
Do you mean the loan repayment program qualifies a person who leaves the state?
She was able to do it. Don't ask me the particulars.
Wow, that's another thing we better check on.
Well, that it could have been, Mr. Chair, that she qualified for the Idaho program.
Well, so. That's interesting.
Better than Oregon.
Well,
yeah.
But I don't want to give a tax credit or a student loan thing and have the person leave and go somewhere else to practice. That's, they're two good points today. Very good. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 12 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 146 with the caveat that we are not going to move this bill today. We have numerous comments on the merits of this bill, and we will start. Do we have a sheet? Who's going to be the main proponent for this bill? Okay. Yeah. The director. Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. Senator members of the committee, Patty Glenn, Executive Director of the
Patty
Oregon Board of Massage Therapists, our Attorney General that represents the board, Lori Lindley, and
we can move another chair up there.
Bring us all up here. Because we know that you're trying to make up some time from Senate Bill 112. Kathy Police, one of our board members, and I'll let her introduce herself.
Okay. Okay, Patty, are you going to go ahead?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Chair Morissette, members of the committee. Senate Bill 146 is before you today. It is a reattempt to pass Senate Bill 170, A and Gross, that this committee passed out last session. But for reasons that aren't really clear to the board, was sent back to committee near the end of session. And then obviously, since you'd already passed it out once, I guess a timely death was its only option at that point.
Now, let's refresh my memory. What's the difference between this bill and the one that we passed last session?
Absolutely nothing except for the word knowingly and a little bit of legislative counsel's, when you get a new council looking at it, they tweak this word or that word. So
okay. There
are no significant differences between the two bills. In fact, what we submitted to legislative council for the concept for this session was the A and Gross bill from last session.
Okay.
You know, we had done work.
Yes. Senator Montezemolo.
Remind us again so I can pull my notes from the last bill, last session. What was the bill number?
I'm sorry, Senate Bill 170.
170.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
I remember that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, and I apologize not having an opportunity to speak with each of you with the short timing of this committee, of this hearing. We appreciate the opportunity to be on your agenda early in session and have the opportunity to work through any challenges that might exist. Just a quick history, a follow-up, the summary that I submitted to you last week in lieu of being able to contact you individually. Senate Bill 170 in the 2007 session was the result of a couple of years' worth of work of a rules committee doing a comprehensive review of both statute and then following that of rule of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists. It had been over a decade since any comprehensive review of the rule statute or rule had been done. And so the board felt like it was timely that there were some issues that needed to be addressed. So just as a quick recap of the issues that are before you in Senate Bill 146, in Section 1, we have added the word program to our certified class definition. Right now, the way that certified class it reads, it could be interpreted to mean that the board actually has to review every single class within a massage therapy program. That isn't actually how we approve the programs in practice. We look at the programs as a whole and whether or not those programs as a whole with each class meet the educational requirements that the board requires for licensure. We leave it up to the discretion of the programs if they feel like a content would be more appropriate in a particular course or another and they need to shift those things around, they're not required to come back to the board every time. But as the committee looked at this, they felt like that could be implied to mean that we actually have to approve every single class, and therefore any changes to a class would need to come back before the board or the board staff. So we would like to add the word program in to allow us to look at it as a program as a whole, and then the schools wouldn't be reported to required to report anything but substantive changes to the program.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Remind me again the different classes. How many different classes are sub?
There's a requirement for 500 hours within the curriculum.
No, I meant how many jurisdictions are under the massage therapist. I mean, this affects massage therapists, but you have others that are affected too.
It affects the programs within the state of Oregon that administer massage therapy programs.
That's massage therapy.
Well, yeah, or the definitions that fit within the definition of massage, yeah, within the definition of massage. So you're right, there are a variety of different modalities or approaches within the massage and bodywork arena that we do regulate under the definition of massage.
Okay.
So I know there's been some concern that this may in some way, shape, or form be attempting to enforce or to enact additional controls over schools. That isn't the case at all. In fact, there's nothing in statute that gives us that authority to do that. We simply have the authority or the requirement to look, a responsibility to look at the curriculum in the state, and we work in conjunction with the Department of Education on that. The next piece is the reorder of the definition of massage. One of the challenges that the committee found with that definition was the long run-on paragraph that had included but not limited to and started listing out examples of different areas or different items that a massage therapist might use within the scope of their practice. With the including but not limited to language, the committee felt like keeping a nice clean definition and then bulleting out or listing in an A, B, C, or D format those four general areas that are covered in that run-on definition would be cleaner and easier for both the licensee and the lay public to understand what they can use. There were also outdated uses of language. For instance, the word vibrator, we mean vibrating appliances, you know, manual massage, but obviously with the massage profession, that's not necessarily a word we'd like to have in the definition of massage. Use of sun lamps, while it was probably more commonly used in its day, which is one of the current words used in statute, no longer a commonly used appliance, but there's other appliances as technologies come along that have taken its place.
What about flexology?
Reflexology is still exempt, as was passed out of this committee last session.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Aiding and abetting language was something we talked about extensively last legislative session as well.
I read your definition, your explanation, but when I read that passage, I wasn't quite sure I knew what it meant. But
a couple of the challenges that we've had, sir, as this profession has continued to grow in leaps and bounds recently, is a dramatic increase in the employment of massage professionals or massage therapists. When I entered this profession about 12 years ago, the majority of licensed therapists were self-employed and working in a self-employed capacity. As the spa industry and healthcare industry have continued to evolve over the last decade, there has been a greater shift to employment of massage therapists.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, one of the things we have seen is individuals who own spas, own clinics, own practices, but are not licensees, engaging in the employment of unlicensed professionals for their own financial gain. Well, it appears to be for their own financial gain. Unfortunately, when that occurs, the Board of Massage would address the unlicensed practice of massage, but is not able to address necessarily the individual who owns the business.
Okay. Now, I would ask members of the committee, do you think this is a satisfactory explanation on line 27 to line 31? Now, to me, it's a little bit lacking, confusing, whatever. But now, your explanation that you just gave is perfectly understandable. Maybe I just didn't make the relationships there.
The client exemption specifically, Senator Morissette, or is it the entire definition from 22 through 31?
Person does not aid, abet, or assist another person who does not have an active massage. Okay.
So these were a couple of the concerns that came up in the 2000, voice concerns in the 2007 session that caused us to add in by amendment, I believe, during committee, those exemptions for the client or for somebody referring someone. And there was some concern that the board might choose to take action against an unlicensed practitioner's client. And obviously, when we're looking at public protection, that's not a reasonable use of our energy and resources as a board of massage. We certainly aren't holding the client responsible for the unlicensed practitioner's role.
Is this your language?
No, that was vetted through Patrick Allen when he was with DCBS, through the LC, through Attorney General, through the board.
Oh. Okay.
A little bit through committee.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I think I understand this. I mean, you know, the client one is relatively...
Yeah.
Clean, I think, and the other one basically says if there is a referral without compensation. So, in other words, if this spa referred said go here and this person is good, and it's not part of their book of business, it's just a referral. You know, if it's part of the book of business, it's another matter. But if it's gratis, there's no money exchanges hands. It's just saying, you know, I think this person might serve you. So,
okay. Any other questions?
I mean, that's the way I read it.
Okay. Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, that was one of the concerns, was that you might choose to refer someone to your massage therapist, and maybe that therapist had let their license lapse or had expired their license, and we didn't believe you should be culpable of unlicensed.
Well, to me, it was a little ambiguous, but. Yes, there's other problems with the mm-hmm.
It happens when lawyers get involved. It gets ambiguous.
Lawyers and CPAs.
Oh, excuse me.
Well, we work at the store.
That wasn't directed at anybody in particular, trust me.
Okay. Just thought I'd raise that point. Okay.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions on the aiding and abetting? Mm-hmm. So obviously there's some other grammatical updates. You switched to the word jurisdiction throughout instead of saying state or territory. That is because we do have jurisdictions within some states. The city of Malibu, for example, in Southern California, was regulating massage at a standard consistently higher to us within their city control, since the state did not have a state licensing law at the time. But because it specifically said state or territory, it allowed a greater piece but didn't allow us to come in and look at if there was a city or an area that regulated it. Equal to what we do here in Oregon, to be able to take their education or their license into consideration.
A jurisdiction would be any area with a governing body.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
Sir. Then the other couple things that we did tweak, we changed
Chair.
Yes, sir.
Sorry, Senator.
Yes, thank you. So a territory, so you would have jurisdiction over massage therapists on tribal lands?
We don't, no, that does not change, would not change that. We work with the tribal nation on issues relative to that, and I believe that almost all the land in the state of Oregon is complying with the massage regulations, but at least that's our understanding from working with the different various tribes. Okay. But that would not change our territories currently in the language. We're actually suggesting we move to jurisdiction as a global language. Right now it says state or territory. We're suggesting we use the term jurisdiction rather than state or territory. But again, this is used in... Sorry, did you have...
No, I'm just saying it's a broader term.
Yeah. Intended to be what we can take for someone coming in. If you look at where jurisdiction is used, it's not so much how we govern or where we regulate, but rather when individuals are coming into the state of Oregon looking for a massage license or to obtain licensure, what we can consider in that capacity. We also brought to you last session the addition of random site inspection, the opportunity for the board to be able to do random site inspections of massage premises. Unlike other professions, we do not have massage establishment licenses as we have in the past. We no longer have that, and the board did not feel there was a need to move back to that level of regulation. But we do have several items within the rules and laws and statutes that pertain to massage that are relevant to the surroundings in which they practice when they have a massage business. And we have seen an increasing number of violations or complaints in that realm over the years, including things like recycling dirty linens, utilizing, reusing bathrobes, those types of things, which are obviously not pleasant to consider. we would like to be able to continue what the board had done previously, which is to do random site inspections in a relationship building and preventative measure. We're in communities on a relatively regular basis doing inspections or investigations relevant to complaints that the board's received. When we're in those communities, as an outreach effort, we'd like to be able to go into our massage establishments, do a random site inspection with those professionals, and be able to provide them feedback on areas where they may be not in compliance. The board, in having done that in the past, always gives a 30-day notice to come into compliance and has worked beyond that 30-day window with anybody who is not in compliance. For example, if they're in the process of remodeling a bathroom and they need 90 days to complete that remodel project or something like that. So this is not something where, as there has been some concern raised, we would be barging into a massage business or walking into a room where a massage was in session. This is a process that we would use to develop relationships with our licensed community and make sure that they are informed of and complying with, but obviously in our charge of public protection to invade that private space of the client or to go into someone's private home where a therapist might be doing outcall isn't consistent with our charge of public protection.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Morrison.
What section is this that you're talking about?
I apologize, Section 10.
Okay. And clarify again, these would be, you would just show up?
That's correct. We would potentially come into the spa or come into that place of business and let them know that the board was there and we would like to do a site inspection on compliance. And then we would obviously open areas or areas that were convenient to and accessible at the time. We would be able to look at immediately. If there were rooms that were currently in use, we may need to schedule a time to come back. Or if everything appeared to be in compliance in all those general areas, more than likely would just consider that sufficient and in that inspection capacity and move on.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Follow up on that. Now, this is, I'm speaking from the nursing profession, but when we have inspections, we're given notice. And even, I think, restaurant inspections, or are they not?
No.
They just happen.
They just happen.
And I don't know why there is
a difference.
Can you clarify why it's necessary not to give them any notice?
I think that the discussion the committee had and the board had, and Ms. Lindley was just mentioning that barbers, cosmetology are not given advance notice either, is that individuals who are blatantly or intentionally violating the law and are aware of what the law should be, for example, the dirty linen example I gave you, would be able to quickly make modifications to their location, and we wouldn't necessarily get a good picture of what's really happening within that establishment. And that's part of the reason why our process is to give them that 30 days advance notice. Or 30 days to come into compliance piece so that, you know, if it was just a minor infraction or a minor error, that that they would be able to make remedy and be aware of that, make those adjustments.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the concern I have, because up till now it's been complaint-driven, and now it's random, but I'm wondering if there shouldn't be still a requirement on the board to respond to complaints, and that's no longer in law. Is it, or am I missing
something?
No,
sir. Laura, do you want to speak to that?
We would always have a response.
Chair
Morissette and Senator Cruz, my name is Lori Lindley. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Massage Board as well as other health-related boards. There would always be a responsibility to investigate any complaint that we have. We have general statutes under ORS 676 that do not give the board a choice as to whether or not to investigate complaints. They're required to do so.
Okay, thank you.
I think that essentially is a summary of everything that I had to share with you today, except for to be available for any questions or answer that you might have.
Further questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Telford.
What's driving the, you know, previously it's been complaint-driven, now it's just kind of open to any establishment. What's driving that?
the site inspection piece, the significant increase in the number of complaints we're having about establishments. And again, as the shift from individual sole practitioners working out of their homes or private practices has moved into the employment industry, we're starting to see more therapists contacting the board saying, you know, my employer is requiring me to do this. Or, for instance, the reusing dirty linens, that came from a licensed massage therapist contacting the board and saying, you know, this is my employer. They're requiring us to pull the least dirty linen back out of the dirty linen when they are short linens, and I'm stuck in the situation where if I raise too much more hassle here about it, then my job may be in jeopardy. And so I'm not sure how to navigate this because my license requires these components to be in place, but the employer or the owner of the facility is telling me I have to do X, Y, and Z instead. So this allows us to come in, again, work with the community, work with the owner of that spa establishment, identify to them what the expectations are, and it kind of helps the therapist to reinforce what the practice of massage is and what the expectations are within that facility that they have to comply with.
Senator Montesanderson asked a question, and I guess I was laughing when you gave the answer about inspections being unannounced. They are unannounced, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That is correct.
One of the complaints that I received by email this morning was from an individual who had their office in their home, and that was their complaint, that it was unannounced. That is not a legitimate complaint as far as you're concerned, right?
Right. I think the issue, Senator, or Chair Morissette, excuse me, that is definitely a little bit of a softer place for us to have to be as a board. We do have a lot of licensed therapists that work out of their home, and yet those facilities where they're practicing in their home are required to be in compliance with the rules.
Right.
So, obviously, if the timing wasn't appropriate, if we were to show up in somebody's home office and there were issues in place that didn't allow an inspection at that time, we would honor those things that they were facing and come back at a later time. We would make every effort to accommodate their and their needs.
Does that serve the purpose of the unannounced inspection, though?
I don't think we'd say we're coming back next Tuesday at 10. But
we'll wait in the car until I clean the place up?
Yeah. I mean, it may, sir. It may, in fact, do that. But obviously, we don't have a right to come barging into their homes. So it would then become an issue with whether or not they were complying with the board's right to inspection, I guess, at that point. So.
Okay, that is interesting, though, because, I mean, that would be kind of a loophole in that inspection law.
I'm going to defer to counsel on this because it's much more.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, Lori Lindley again. I think there's some deference given to the board if you were to change the statute in terms of how they decide to enforce this. I think the board would have to perhaps create some rules on this a little further. They have 4 pages of rules right now about sanitary requirements, et cetera, so it probably could be further defined in rule if you're concerned about the home inspection issue to provide some privacy but yet still enforce their laws.
Okay, it just seems that if they're going to practice in their home, there would be a place set aside to do that practice.
Mm-hmm.
That being the case, then your rule should apply to them as well as anybody else. I mean, it just seems to me that would be understood by those people who set up an office in their home. And I don't think there would be any excuse for them to say, no, I'm not ready right now. And that's just my...
Senator Chair and members of the committee, Lori Lindley again, I do agree with you. I think that this language would allow them to enforce the laws to everyone equally. But you would perhaps, you know, get complaints from people using the home as their defense. I don't think that's going to absolve them of using that to the defense. And that would probably maybe become an issue in a contested case or in a hearing process.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Morissette, just as a follow-up on that, it really has been my experience in the last 5 years of being the executive director of the Board of Massage that our licensees are for the most part compliant with the rules and laws in Oregon and are more than welcome to invite the board in to get that feedback and that information. When I originally came to the board back in 2004, we were doing, under a different AG opinion, some random site inspections under board complaint when we were in the community doing other enforcement action. And at that time, have had great relationships and even received letters of thank you from those establishments where we had done site inspections. But in looking at the language of the statute and having Lori Lindley as our AG, we revisited whether or not we really had the authority and set aside doing them at that time until we had clear statutory authority to be able to move forward with that.
Thank you. Did you have a response?
I had a couple of...
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. my name is Heather Benori. I am on the executive committee of the Oregon Massage Therapists Association and am here at the request of our president, Robert Bike. I would like to address Senator Telfer's concerns about the need for the random site inspections. As a Portland area representative, I receive a number of calls from our members and sometimes even non-members complaining about situations that they face in their employment structure where things are not correct or someone has hired an unlicensed therapist and they personally are afraid for their job to make any link. They don't even want to identify themselves to me. They are afraid to make that link to the board for fear of their own job or other repercussions, but know that things that are going on are inappropriate and feel something needs to be done about it. They call me, give me what information they can about the facility, and I in turn report those to the board in my name. And this would allow for the board to address some of these things in areas where this is perhaps happening on a continuing basis without needing to have a complaint. They can go in and look at a site. In terms of the home, I don't want to speak for Patty, but if she, my interpretation of coming in at an inappropriate time, if someone does work out of their home, as I have an office within my home, and the board showed up, well, I had a birthday party for my daughter, and clearly there was no massage being practiced at the time, it would not be an appropriate time to... And that is what I perceive as it being inappropriate to come in. I would keep that room ready for a massage, but, you know, in the middle of a family gathering or something, it makes it a little bit different in terms of, by everybody, I've got to go deal with work right now. And I'm guessing, and I'll let her speak to this, that that is more along the lines of what she was referencing as opposing to my responsibility to keep that area in its appropriate condition.
I see.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, that was exactly my intention. I apologize if that was not clear.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Morissette, committee members. My name is Kathy Cullis, and I am a public member of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists. I am also currently the vice chairman of the board. In addition to that, in my work life, I am the program coordinator of Lane Community College's massage therapy program. And I'd just like to take your a minute.
No, excuse me.
Yes.
Tell me your name one more time.
Kathy Cullis.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Thank you.
As a member of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists, I have sworn to protect the public. And the board has spent considerable amount of time reviewing these statute changes, and many of these changes are in a direct result from enforcement cases that we have seen come before us. And by allowing the board to make these changes in their statute, it will enable us to be more responsive to protecting the public. I would like to take your a minute of your time just to tell you one case that came before us just recently. It was a case of a spa in Eugene that had hired an unlicensed massage therapist. And this goes along with our request to change the statute in the aiding and abetting, in addition to add the aiding and abetting wording in that statute. So they had hired an unlicensed massage therapist. The licensed massage therapist in that place of employment knew that this person was unlicensed. We had a complaint come before the board on this unlicensed massage therapist, and this spa owner, who was not a licensed massage therapist, he was only the business owner. And so we were not able to do any sanction against that business owner for hiring that unlicensed massage therapist. We could only go after the unlicensed massage therapist, which left it open to the business ultimately maybe not learning their lesson and perhaps hiring someone again that was unlicensed, which had an impact on the licensed massage therapists that were in that establishment. Therefore, you know, we were protecting those licensed massage therapists that had followed the rules and had been licensed, and were trying and were working within the confines of the rules and laws of the massage practice.
Questions?
Senator Monson.
Just so that I understand, so basically when you had the found out that there was an unlicensed massage therapist, you could only sanction the unlicensed person, but not, and so that's what section,
yes, that's
whatever section it is. Tell me.
That's so section two of, section of 687. Yes, that's
to correct. Make sure that's the intent.
That's correct.
In this particular case, Senator Morissette, Chair Morissette and members of the committee, we were able to sanction the business owner for unlicensed advertising because that has a broader definition or broader authority. Unfortunately, in this situation, the unlicensed professional has paid the fines and complied with the board. The business owner has refused to respond and is now sitting on a default order and probably on his way to collections. So clearly not learning the lesson. We were able to take some action because of the advertising component, but only because he happened to have advertised for massage therapy, and we were able to address it from that angle, not because of the employment or his propensity to employ unlicensed individuals.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's knowingly, which is somewhat gray. So what level of due diligence is required by the employer? I mean, do they have to get a hold of you to make sure that the license is valid and certified? I mean, what is their level of diligence in
Thank
this?
Thank you, Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz. You'll notice, in addition to the knowingly, there's a one warning requirement that the board has to give them one warning.
Right.
So currently available, they can place a phone call to our office or they can go online to the internet. On our website, we have a license lookup and they can verify that that individual is licensed.
I guess, Ms. Chair, if I could, it's okay. I have one of these spa thingies, and I'm not quite sure how it fits in with my phone operation. We'll figure that out later. And I have somebody present for employment, and they say they're licensed, and they show me a certificate, okay, which could be fraudulent as far as, but, you know, they say they're licensed, they show me their credentials, I'm clear. Is that correct?
Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, obviously the board's going to do their due diligence, and if that person has done their due diligence and the credential that was presented to them was falsified, I think that the board would recognize that as having at least made a solid attempt at doing their due diligence. Our licensees are required to post their license.
Right.
So they should be providing a valid license at that place of business for that employer. And that... you know, what level of due diligence? We'd certainly do enforcement actions where licensees have been suspended and revoked during the course, and arguably there is a valid piece of paper out there somewhere with their name on it. I would hope that employers of massage therapists are truly doing their due diligence and set up some sort of a process by which they're reviewing who's working for them on a somewhat regular basis to make sure that the public is safe. But obviously, when we're talking about enforcing this, we're going to look at whether or not they had the reasonableness of the verification process that they went through. And certainly having a valid license in their hand or in a file folder seems to be fairly due diligent on their part.
Okay, follow up?
Yes.
Okay, because this is a new addition to my book of business, this spa thingy. And I've hired somebody, and it turns out that the credentials they presented to me were fraudulent. And I say, boy, I better not get hit with that again. So somebody else comes, and everything looks good. And I say, well, I'm going to double check, so I call you. How cumbersome is that for me to do?
In most cases, that phone's answered immediately, and it's about a 30-second phone call at most.
Okay.
And if you're computer savvy, you can just go on the board's website.
No, he's not.
You're not?
I am wondering if I actually left my employment with the board and came to practice in rural Southern Oregon, if there might be tax credits. On the farm.
Well, we could work on that. Thank you,
Sorry,
Mr.
Chair Morrison.
Well, but it should be online, right?
It is online.
Whatever that means.
By the
Okay, Okay.
If you'd like, I can give you some random names. You can call the office this afternoon and confirm if you need.
Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the kind of protection that you're trying to offer the public because of the personal nature of your business. I know that you want to keep that highly professional image that can be really destroyed by the wrong people getting into your profession. I have a little trouble, though, with Section 10. I have no problem with you going after people that have the wrong people in or doing the wrong things. I guess I have a little problem with the no notice. OSHA gives you notice, even though if it's a complaint and sometimes not a complaint, just to do an inspection. I mean, most places do, so I just want to express to you, I have a little problem with that, mainly because not of the people that are doing the wrong thing, but of the people that are doing the right thing. And so you aren't complaint-driven, so you go in, and there's a little bit of offense, I think, maybe, to that by someone who really works hard to hold up the professional end of your of the massage therapist organization. So
OSHA doesn't always give notice, by the way.
Well, sometimes they don't. And probably if it's a complaint, it's more likely not to. Yeah.
Chair Morissette, Senator Berger, just to go back to share with you the experience that I had when I came into the board and the way that they were handling those inspections at the time, they were done in an amazingly professional manner and very supportive and like I indicated, proactive. Well, the intent was to be proactive and informative. I believe, from what I was told by our board, the reason I was hired is to work on building a relationship or reestablishing a relationship between the board and our licensed community. While our charge is public protection, I have yet to find anywhere in statute the definition of public being at the exclusion of our licensees. And so I think it's very important that as we're enforcing issues relative to the client or the patient public, that we are making sure that we're doing them in such a way that is not overly burdensome or offensive to the licensee population in which we regulate. So I will share with you that I was very impressed by how they were being handled, by the responsiveness. As I mentioned, we actually had received thank you cards saying I wasn't aware that was a requirement, and I appreciate you making that aware. So that would be the way in which we would continue to handle them, and certainly would put, as Lori Lindley indicated, rules and policies in place that would assure that continued not only today but in the future as well. So I would definitely hear you and understand your concerns. So.
Thank you. But if the success of the bill hinged on getting 16 votes in the Senate, would you consider removing that?
I think at this
just
point,
a hypothesis. I have no idea.
I think it is an important component for future safety. If we need to come back to you again with this, then maybe we'll be coming back again. So.
Senator. In response to Senator Mona Sanderson on that, I think that the critical issue here is as long as it's a complaint-driven system, you aren't going to have any internal checks and balances. And I think that's the main driver of this is for somebody who's working for a business establishment that has some concerns, they need to have some avenue for remedy. And if it's complaint-driven, then it's a formal avenue for remedy, and it doesn't allow them to express concerns in an informal way and get action. I believe
that is a good example. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Senator Cruz raised an interesting question a minute ago. What happened last session? We passed this bill.
Destroyed relationships.
From what I've been able to ascertain, Senator Morris said, and since it came back to committee, you may have a better sense of why it came back than I might. But I believe there was some confusion since we had two bills coming through this committee last session, one, the reflexology exemption bill, and then our bill, Senate Bill 170, as to exactly how those two bills would collide. I'm pretty clear on the fact that we would have still exempted reflexology by the end of the session, but I believe there was some confusion about whether this would, in fact, negate or undo that exemption.
Okay, so the bill passed out of committee and then came back to committee at the end of the session. And
did not make it to the Senate floor for a vote.
I see. Okay. That was okay.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Jen Hodges. And Rose Jade. Then I believe the only other person to testify in favor would be Cindy Roberts. Where is Cindy? Is she in the room? Okay, go ahead and get started, please.
Thank you very much. Oh, my. I'm far too short for these microphones, usually.
Go ahead. My name's Rose Jade. I'm a licensed massage therapist in Newport. I'm here on my own behalf as a licensed massage therapist and as a client. I spoke before you 2 years ago when Senate Bill, let me put my glasses on, Senate Bill 170 came, and in my written testimony, I've provided a lot of detailed information about the old bill and this bill and the differences. My opposition 2 years ago was seated in my status as a student newly coming out of massage school and as a longtime client of massage. Today I'm before you with a year of professional experience under my belt. I work in a day spa as an independent contractor, and if the current massage board thinks I'm a pain in their side, I'm really a pain in the side of the person who owns that spa, because I make sure that everyone posts their license and, you know, things like that. But my concerns are the same that they were 2 years ago. And I've detailed them. I don't want to take up your time today, but I would ask you to carefully review my notes. I have also included some additional information, because what happened after this bill died in committee 2 years ago was the board went back and gave itself all of its authority, expanded authority, that it was asking from you. And after you denied it, they gave it to themselves through administrative rulemaking. And I've included that information in here. The administrative rulemaking took approximately 6 months, and it just finished up. The rules were initially to go into effect July 1st of last year without any legislative approval of that old bill. They're now set to go into effect, I believe, February 1st.
Now, let me try to get this clear. The administrative rulemaking, in your opinion, did more than enhance the existing statute. It changed the nature of the statute.
I have, in my testimony, I have given you details, because that's a pretty big charge to make.
Yeah,
but yes,
okay.
They went back and gave themselves all of the things they asked from the legislature.
Okay.
They did it by administrative rulemaking.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think it's really important for you to go over some of the opposition, because then it's on public record also, although you handed it out to us. But you said that at the bottom of your third page that massage board members are not required to have teaching certificates, let alone certificates in curriculum development, unless and until they are so required, it makes no sense to give the board such broad, unfettered control over an entire curriculum. Can you explain your interpretation of their intent with that change?
Well, you know, my understanding of it is based on, let me go back to the rulemaking process, because there was a group of us massage therapists who did, including some instructors at a state university educational setting, who did petition the board about that particular issue, wanting to expand from classes to entire programs. And the board took 6 months to 5 months to respond to us. And that is also, that petition and their response is included and referenced in my objections. My understanding is that they want to remove the legislative, the language in the statute that gives you, the legislature, control over hours and subject matters, and they want it, because if you look at their draft, it takes it out, and then they will get complete control over entire massage programs. And part of this was driven by their and this is in the petition and the response, they want to see the fraternization policies that that instructors at state universities have with students and be able to use a violation of an employment contract or fraternization contract to discipline, presumably an instructor at the university, even though the community college isn't going to discipline them for anything that happened. And that was a great concern to the instructors and some of the students. When I was a student at the Lane Community College, many of us became friends with our instructors. I'm 10 years older than my instructor. And, fraternization is, I think the definition is amicable. You know, we have a relationship, but there's some things that apparently the board, wasn't wanting to happen. And, I hope that answers your question.
Now, how widely did you circulate?
I sent this to you, and I brought the copies. I haven't sent it to anybody else. I sent it to you because I didn't think I was going to...
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I got your message, and I ran off part of this. I didn't run off all of these pages, and this morning I was running off some things, but I didn't do this, so I'm glad that you came.
And I brought extra copies.
Okay, so this is now the public record.
Yes.
Okay, so the board can take a look at this and respond at some point.
Right, and I would just like to, if I could have another minute, I would like to address, although he's not here, Senator Cruz's concern about if he... what do we do about these employees who don't want to make a formal complaint? You can make an informal, anonymous complaint. So employees, if they're worried about a working condition, they can call up the board and make an anonymous complaint. And I'd like to point out that, there was a time when the legislature required the massage board to do annual inspections of premises. And then it was moved to every other year because there just wasn't resources available, and I don't think the cost-benefit analysis came out for people to do this. I have a mobile license. That means I can go anywhere in the city of Newport. Some cities don't require an individual business license on top of being an LMT. But I think that if the section about, basically warrantless searches, you might call them random inspections, but I, as a defense attorney, I call them a warrantless search. Even when an administrative agency seeks to do a search of a premise, they can go to an administrative law judge and get a search warrant if they really think there's something going on at that premise. That is available to the board right now. If the board wants to go see somebody, stop in and say hi, somebody is free to let them in. But as someone who goes into a private home with my massage table, if this was to pass, I would have an immediate conflict. Do I tell my 75-year-old client who can't get out of her house that with me comes the board? Because that's what's going to happen. If I tell her that, she's probably not going to want me to come in and give her a massage.
Okay, so what you're saying is that because you practice your mobile, you practice wherever you go to the client's home.
I also work at the day spa. But
so then the client's home would become your workplace.
That's if you read the language of that section, it says where massage is practiced.
The premises
upon which. There's no exemption for private residences.
Oh,
and I think that I'd like to remind the board the committee that I too think that the board has some good ideas, and I think that they have some concerns. But Patty Glenn is not the board. Patty Glenn is not the investigator. And Patty Glenn's assurances aren't binding on that board. What's binding is going to be the language of the statutes and the language of the rules. So I urge you to carefully review my comments, and I thank you for your time.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Yes, yeah. Senator Mara Sanderson.
Okay, I think it's important for the board to take a look at this because I can't explain, for instance, the change of the definition of eliminating the phrase with or without as it currently appears, then she goes on to say that someone that are not licensed could not apply a topical preparation such as a salve, bath oil, or moisturizing lotion. I mean, there's some nitty-gritty in here that'll be very, I think, important for you to look at and let us know. And then on page 7, they...
and these are raising red flags. That's why it's really important for you to respond to them where the board is going to exempt anyone who knowingly aids, abets, or assists in the unlicensed practice of massage, and they give reasons why. At the same time, you're seeking an express exemption of clients of unlicensed massage and for people who make uncompensated referrals to an unlicensed masseuse. I mean, all of these, the devil's in the details. So since this is my first look at it, I certainly, a lot of this I just don't understand. So I would rather have you tell us, explain what the opposition is, and then definitely have the board respond to those.
If I may quickly, Chair Morissette. During the rulemaking period in the last 6 months, I gave all of these objections and more in detail in writing to the board's rule committee, and 29 pages, and they had no response and they made no changes. So they've heard, this isn't news to them. So thank you.
She's wordy. She's very wordy. I had her as a student. She's very wordy. Thank you for your...
Okay, let the record show
that Rose is wordy.
Thank you for your time and for your careful
introduce yourself, please.
Consideration. I'm Jennifer Hodges. And did you all get the email from me? Okay.
You have that.
So I want to say a few things kind of in comment to... what Patty was saying earlier, and then maybe answer some of the questions, and then I'm also I'm a massage therapist, and I'm also an instructor at Lane Community College, and have been for 10 years.
Now, you guys were here last time, right?
Yes. Yes.
It's all coming back.
I didn't have a chance to speak to you, but I spoke to your assistant last year. I also do out-call massage. I don't have a massage office that I work out of.
Okay.
So I also have the same concern with my clients of there is no language written in that that exempts someone else's home, a client's home. So that's a concern to me. Another concern that I have...
Excuse me.
Yes.
First of all, there is no prohibition for what you are doing as an out, doing your work somewhere else. So that's perfectly legal.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And the fact that it is not mentioned in the bill, except that your office is where you do the work, which happens to be in someone else's home.
Right.
And by implication, they could visit that home while you were working on a patient and make sure everything was okay. I
That's
understand.
Correct.
Okay.
We are expected as massage therapists by rule to follow the same sanitation rules, whether we're in our own office or whether we go to someone's home, which clearly is difficult. If you go to a client's home, they may or may not have a trash can a lid on their trash can. It's kind of hard to enforce that sort of thing. That's a whole other matter. But another concern that I have, you guys talked about, and I believe Senator Verger made comment, and there was made comment of the random inspection, which the board has been doing by their admission, and I posted the Borderline newsletter from 2003 that where they said they were going to start doing more common random inspections, even though, in my opinion, they didn't have legislative authority to do so at that time, but have been. And I brought that up to them numerous times because I've been to a lot of board meetings talking to them about that. One of the concerns that I really have is, you know, you go into a restaurant, nobody's naked, hopefully. That's the idea. When you're in a massage, your clients are undressed. I have a couple of my colleagues, one specifically who works only with survivors of sexual abuse. And this is a really delicate thing. I mean, I don't know about your familiarity with that, but as a massage therapist, and we have a great many more clients coming to us in an attempt to reclaim their body, and it requires a lot of trust, and it takes a long time to develop that trust. And having a knock on the door and a random person walking in is not an okay thing.
in those circumstances. And so I'd really like to see some sort of parameter, something built in that would protect those people. If the board is trying to protect the public, then we need to consider all of the public, all of the people who are receiving massage at that in that time. So that's a really large concern that I have. Let's see. Another concern I have as a instructor in a massage program is the addition of the word program, and it looks fairly benign. And I have heard the board's claim that, you know, it's just so that we don't have to do class by class kind of stuff, that like Patty had said. But you may not know that by rule they just passed, and I have been going back and forth with them for some time about their desire to add a fractionization policy, that the schools have to present a fractionization policy. Lane Community College has no fractionization policy. And in my discussions with the head boss at the downtown center where I work, it's fairly impractical to do a fractionization policy. I mean, we're all adults. I mean, by example, 2 years ago, when this was all going on, I was fraternizing with Rose a lot. She's an attorney. She's really smart. And she knew her way around these legislative things. She actually came to me and told me about Senate Bill 170 2 years ago. So it wasn't like I was going out and, you know, eliciting help from my students. She's the one that came to me as an attorney and said, "Did you know about this?" And I said, "No, I wasn't aware of that." And we started working together. I also worked with a couple other students with that who came to me and were opposed to Senate Bill 170. And so to say that I can't fraternize with Rose or another student who in all other walks of life would be considered my elder. I hate to point out the obvious, but I think it's an insult to Rose, and I think it's an insult to me and to other instructors that we can't make those kinds of decisions as adults to be able to decide who we're going to fraternize with. You know, massage is a small profession. People come in and out. 2 years ago, about, I was taking a class at Lane Community College in the massage program where I was teaching at the time. And my instructor was also an instructor in the program who I teach with all the time. And so all of a sudden, I'm a student in her class. This is a concern. Now suddenly I can't fraternize with this person. I mean, this is a concern to me. So I don't think that their statement that it's just for the paperwork. It's just for this. It's not that. And if you look at the rules, you will see that the one rule that they changed in relation, they've already added the word program mm-hmm. to their rules, even though y'all 2 years ago said no. They have done that. They voted it in. It's been approved. And they also add in there that schools have to. The only thing that they've changed in that rule area is that the need for a fraternization policy and code of ethics policies.
We're running out of time, and there's one more individual, Cindy Roberts. There she is. So I'm going to have to call on Cindy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Cindy, would you come up, please? Of course. And we're not going to move this bill today. So
okay.
We're going to.
We'll get you some more letters.
Oh, okay. Cindy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the American Massage Therapy Association of Oregon, and I will be brief because I know you have run over quite long on this issue. But I want to tell you that I represent 1,200 licensed massage therapists in Oregon. They've participated in this bill now for 3 years. They've participated in rulemaking for decades, and we have no problem with this legislation or the process by which it was brought. We are the largest group of professionals that are regulated by the OBMT, and we believe this is a good bill. We believe it is updating of language and clarification of applicability. The only two standards that you could consider new are aiding and abetting and the inspection piece. Both of those issues are based on the fact that massage is more prevalent now, and businesses doing mass massage are more prevalent now. Those were two issues that needed to be addressed. We do not believe they're significant changes. I have a huge concern, sir, that this bill is being held up again by concerns that are being tossed out that are unsubstantiated and unfair. No one should be assigning reasoning to OBMT as to why they do what they do. Patty Glenn and her board members are here, and you can ask them. Lane Community College has a fraternization policy. They are not directed by any board, including the OBMT. Fraternization policies are dictated by the school. All schools have them. They write them, and it's for all professionals. OBMT does not discipline teachers. That was just thrown out as a possibility. The possibility of having someone come into your home if you call for a massage therapist and have your home inspected is absolutely ridiculous. It says clearly in this legislation that's based on business location and premise only. In 2003...
Now, wait a minute. What if they don't have a business location?
There's nothing to be inspected then. Their practice and how they behave practice-wise can be inspected, but there's nothing that can be dropped
so
in on.
So if their practice is solely going to people's homes, they do not have a business location to inspect.
Exactly, sir. The way it is worded in the bill, it's talking about premise locations, and they are more prevalent now, premise locations, and mass ones as well, where you have six massage tables in one place. In 2003, the authority to inspect did change. In fact, it was just brought up to you that inspections were going on when they weren't supposed to be going on. OBMT had not been using its authority correctly. In fact, true statement, but that was fixed in 2003 when Patty Glenn became the executive director of OBMT and made sure that they were not overstepping their bounds. So the amount of concern, I've been doing this for 19 years, and I'm thrilled that we have public that wants to be involved and that comes to the legislature and speaks to you as the people who have to deal with this law and the changes you make every day. But I have to say that I'm very concerned that a very small group of people have held up what is really a technical bill now for 3 years.
That's what my administrative assistant told me, that if we heard this bill, we could move it very quickly because it was just a technical bill.
Yes, right? Sir. Yes, sir.
Uh-huh.
And
I forgot we'd... Okay.
Mr. Chair, the people in my association have never felt like they were being abused in any way, shape, or form by OBMT. We've been involved in all the rulemaking, all the changes. We've always been notified when changes were going to come. We've always been asked our opinion. And not only in the rules, but in this law as well. I've never found the OBMT to be in any way a gotcha type establishment who just wants to come out and beat us up. They are partnering with us. They help us, even with the establishments that they're coming and inspecting, yes, without warning. They're still coming with the sole purpose of not getting you in trouble, but helping you to live up to the law. Sorry.
No.
I'm sorry, sir.
I understand your feeling. Now, what I want you to do is get a copy of the public testimony that they gave, and I want you to...
Like that?
Yeah.
I'd like to see what...
Well, it's
the new
we have copies,
are.
Right? Mm-hmm. And you can get a copy. And
thank you.
Yes, Senator Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 10, which you'll have an opportunity to see when you see this testimony that we've had, it says under a new rule, this is in reference to the inspections. Under this rule, an LMT can be fined up to $1,000 by the board, be fined $6,250 in criminal court, and go to prison for a year for refusing to allow the board's agent to enter any premise where massage is being practiced. Would you disagree or agree with that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I do not have the enforcement ability. I do not know the list of crimes. I do not know how much they charge, but I find that so incredibly difficult to even swallow that could possibly be the truth.
Okay. I don't know if there are extra copies of this testimony. There are supposed to be 25 copies made. If there are not extra copies, we will make a copy for you.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that. And actually, Senators, I would have taken up much less of your time, as we all would have, had we had those complaints in advance, and I could have answered them in advance as well. So I look forward to doing that, and I'll send you emails.
Well, this is kind of the full employment bill that we have. Keeps a number of people busy.
Yes.
But I think it's a very important issue that we are involved in, and obviously we will take the time to consider all of the concerns and your response to the concerns, and hopefully we will be able to move this bill. One of the reasons we're starting early on this.
Senator, I appreciate that, and two things on that. First of all, I could have my 1,200 members come here and testify or write letters, and I know you don't want that, so I'm hoping that you'll accept that as I speak here, I'm here for several people, not just a few. And secondly, I appreciate the fact that you started early, but I also want you to understand that we started this piece of legislation at the compromise level we had last session, and then made a couple more language improvements like jurisdiction, state. But for the most part, we didn't go back and start at the beginning. We took all the changes from 2007 and started from there.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Can I follow up on that? Would you agree or disagree, however, that when Senate Bill 170 did not pass, that then rules were changed to address many of the things in the Senate bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I think that where you can change the rules to address the concerns of the overall regulatory body, which is my group, that's good. But I have never, ever seen OBMT in any way ever step legislative intent with its rulemaking. I have not seen it. I would love to see evidence of that. But no, I do not think rules were made to bend the statute to their need. No.
Okay. And that's really the crux of the matter, if that is true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're almost finished, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, we have written testimony in addition to what we've heard today from three individuals for the record in opposition of Senate Bill 146. Kelly Holland, David Zuno, and Jana Lee.
Okay, thank you. Now,
do we have copies of those?
We've got emails.
Yeah, and we'll make... Where's the?
I got emails from all those.
Okay.
Books,
okay. Now there are a number of bills that we did not get to. Senate Bill 164, Senate Bill 173, Senate Bill 174. I apologize to those of you who were here for that. I apologize profusely. They will be carried over until Wednesday. So. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 146, and we will adjourn.
Okay.
This seems like kind of an anticlimactic.
Well, okay.